Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
I'm going to go and say safety. I feel really safe here. There's not a lot of crime here. The police don't carry guns. People don't carry guns. So I feel like really safe. Like if I see a policeman walking by, like I have no fear at all. At all. I've never been stopped by a policeman here. So it's just a certain level of security here, you know.
My experience is, for the most part, has been really good. Police don't, you know, profile me as much as they used to back in the States.
I would have to definitely say safety is number one thing that kind of drawn my wife and I to call Japan home.
This may sound a little strange, a little hyperbolic, but here in Japan, I am a free black man. I came here when I was 21. It's the first time, well, that was almost 40 years ago. Next January will be 38 years ago, nearly 40 years ago. But living here, I feel free. I don't fear the police. I feel like a free black man. Actually, just a free man. And I'm not exaggerating here. Forgive me if it sounds hyperbolic, but no, really. If for some drastic reason Japan changes, I may have to go somewhere else.
A lot of black people feel safer in Asia.
There's a lot of things, little subtle things that I do in Japan or is done that's, you know, makes me feel at home. But if I compare it to other experiences I've had as a black man, the safety and the lack of police, like racial profiling, and even if you do have some sort of interaction with the police, I mean, there's, you know, you never... I've never talked to anyone who at any time started feeling in fear in a, you know, in some sort of physical way. And I saw your video when you got stopped over in Tokyo. And yeah, I mean, yeah, at best it's troublesome. You are a lot nicer than I am, but I don't think at any time you ever think like, hey, these guys are going to, you know, throw me down in the hood and really just embarrass me and, you know. So, yeah, I mean, how can you not like that?
I just think, like, for me, I always want to encourage all blacks to, you know, up their game up, especially black Americans. Like, I just feel that we kind of stay in our country where we're discriminated against in our own country. We build a wilderness up for everybody else to come over. I'm not going to get into that right now. And I feel like we're getting discriminated in our own country like we're foreigners and we're not. You know, so I really want black Americans to know there's a place for you. There's a place in Rwanda. I'm there. Place in Ghana. I'm there, too. There's a place in Japan. So you should come over and let's build together.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, June 17, 2020. So I have been told. Global system of racism. Right now, so much of what has been happening this year has been global and historic in scope. The protests against the police killings of black people and racism in general, as well as the COVID-19 pandemic, all have been having an impact all around the world. As does the system of white supremacy, racism. And just for context, I reckon, because I think it's important really for everything, racism, the protests, and COVID-19, we have had just since, I believe, March, since everything kind of got serious in the States with COVID-19. We have had the fortune of having folks on the program from China, Austria, South Korea, London, Brazil, Canada, Norway. We have failed to get some folks from the continent. Keep at it. That is important. But getting a global perspective, I do think that there is a huge value in that. Just being able to check in and, you know, see what's happening in different parts of the world and get different information, share, exchange views on white supremacy, racism, as well as a lot of other topics, things that are happening. Extremely helpful, particularly with everything that has happened this year. With that, you can add to the list. Japan, I actually saw spectacular content on the YouTube channel, Black Experience Japan. I saw it, I think, before all of this with the coronavirus and the protest and all of that really got rolling. And I was surprised because they were talking about white supremacy. It was mentioned specifically in a number of the descriptions for the different broadcasts and things that they have, including a documentary. And they were talking to a lot of different black people and some non-black people, but a lot of different black people mostly, just about their experience coming to different parts of so-called Asia, Japan, Singapore, Vietnam, China, talking about their experience, getting away from racism. You heard some of that in the sound clip at the beginning, feeling of being safer and, hey, I don't have to worry about, you know, any George Floyd type situations, no Breonna Taylor type situations. Feel like I can relax. The police go by and my heart doesn't have to, you know, ramp up. I don't think that they're going to, you know, snatch me down on the ground and demand, where am I going? Am I selling cigarettes illegally? Very interesting content to hear their different perspectives and to make sure it's not all, you know, it's spectacular and everything is great. There are some experiences of, you know, I didn't get the best treatment and maybe it was because I'm a black person. Some of that too, but either way, all very informative, great content. I would encourage folks to go to YouTube and check it out. Lots of subscribers. He's been doing spectacular work for a good period of time. Black Experience Japan. We are so thankful to have him on the program. With the wacky time difference, it worked out perfectly because we are at our normal broadcast time. For me, it is 5 p.m. here in Seattle. For him, all the way on the other side of the planet, is 9 a.m. Thursday morning. But things worked out well. Joining us live from Japan, our guest, Mr. Renzo. Are you with us, sir?
I am.
Ohio.
Thanks for having me.
Ohio. Thank you so much for hanging out with us this Thursday morning. For our listeners, again, if you have not visited the channel, subscribe, all that good stuff. Great content on racism, white supremacy, Black Experience Japan. Just if you could give our listeners a little bit of info about who you are and the work that you do.
Okay, well, I'm a black man living in Japan. And what I do is there's two things with the work I do. I was doing like live streams before when I moved to Japan, and live streams and video, and people kept asking me what it was like to be black in Japan. And I was getting the question so much that I felt like I wanted to answer it, but I felt like my experience or the experience of my wife or my family here would not be sufficient, right? So I wanted to get diverse views from black people across Japan. So I'm like, you know what, why not ask multiple people and do it? So that's what I did. And the next thing, too, was that there was a sense from people who watch videos, non-black people, who thought that black people only came to Japan and other countries to just take, right? That we had nothing to contribute to the societies, etc. So I got, you know, I got questions, not questions, but statements like that were made. When you're a black creator online, usually you do attract racist people sometimes, right? And they would spam your stuff and they would do all sorts of things like that. So I was getting some of those statements and I'm like, you know what? These people are so like ignorant, uninformed, all these things. And we understand the way it is. So I'm like, you know what? I also want to show people who the black people in Japan are, because the thing is, black people in Japan, the vast majority, when you come to Japan, you have to be contributing something to the society. It's not a place you can just walk in and say, hey, I'm going to take over, or I'm going to just walk in and just lounge. When you come to Japan, you come to work. You come to Japan, you come to contribute something to society. So I wanted to broadcast sort of like a profile piece of individual black people, so people understand who they were as people, right? And as a source to inspire other black people as well. And also, on the flip side, if they come in contact with the content, for those ignorant people to understand that black people are way more than they believe we are. So yeah, it's twofold.
Experience Japan, subscribe, like, spectacular content. How long have you been operating the channel?
We started in 2017.
Right on, 3 years. Okay. Strong start. Hopefully you'll have many more years of successful content to come. You already said you're a black male, yes?
I am.
Right on. And what part of the world were you born in?
I was born in Jamaica.
Okay, okay, okay. And how long have you been in Japan?
Coming up to my, I'm entering my fifth year, so my fourth year is going to conclude this summer. Oh, snap, in like what, 2 months?
Wow.
I Japan in August 2016.
Okay, okay. So did you make that move directly from Jamaica to Japan, or did you have some other detours before you got there?
Yeah, so when I left Jamaica, actually, and I immigrated to Canada, right? And then I was living there, and then I moved from Canada with my family to Japan. You know, I was talking with my wife. We had a conversation. I had a conversation with someone at this place I was working, and she was talking about Japan. Like, she was a manager, and she said, oh, I was in Japan for 2 years. I'm like, really? I'm like, you know, I always wanted to visit Japan. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to talk to my wife and see, because she said she went on this program. And I'm like, you know what? Let me talk to my wife, because my wife is actually a trained teacher from Canada. So I'm like, you know what? Hey, let's see what can happen. So I went home, I spoke with my wife, and it just turned out that the deadline for that very program was 2 weeks out. So right at the moment when I had a conversation, it was 2 weeks out. So I'm like, oh, this might be fate, because I think it's like almost a year or something like that. Between like 6 months to a year is just the application period. And I got it at the tail end. So I'm like, this must be destiny or something. So I spoke to my wife. We looked it up. We saw 2 weeks and we just started the process. So we moved here. So she was with it. So yeah, we just moved from Canada, me, her, my daughter, to Japan.
Okay. What part of Canada were you all in?
Ontario.
Toronto specifically, or?
No. So, well, I've lived in different places across Canada, but Ontario. So Toronto was first, or maybe Scarborough to be specific, and then Brampton. But we were living in Mississauga at that time. So it's in the greater Toronto area.
Okay, okay. We have listeners there and failed retreat there and all kinds of things. So good to get details. All right. For our program, I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. I use them as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. That definition is a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
I believe that there is a system of white supremacy, of course. I believe that. In terms of your definition, I guess it seems accurate to me. Sounds accurate to me.
Okay. I told listeners, if you check Black Experience Japan, if you look at the descriptions, you'll see the term white supremacy in some of the descriptions, and racism. They talk about it all the time. If you listen, certainly you'll hear those terms. Do you have a definition that you use for the term white supremacy, racism? Do you have a definition that you normally have for those terms?
You know what? I actually have never tried to define it. So to me, it's almost like one of those things that I understand innately, the system. Usually when I think about that, I think about black people specifically, right? How things are stacked against us. For instance, that's what I think about when I think about white supremacy. I usually never even thought about other people that are non-white. I usually think about black people and, what we have to go through. So that's what I go, that's what one a part of my work is against, of course. Specifically, I target media. Because I believe that media is one of the tools that has been deployed or utilized to sort of like subjugate black people and, I guess, shed white supremacy abroad, and that's why even in Asia, I believe people have certain viewpoints, and it's as a result of media itself. So that's my view. White supremacy is a system that was constructed and built to hold black people down and keep us in a subservient position as long as humanly possible. That's, I guess, my definition of it.
As long as humanly possible. That's why we should have a sense of urgency about solving this problem. Try to emphasize that all the time. Okay, so where are you at specifically in Japan?
Tokyo.
Tokyo, okay, big city. Wow, lots of it. Do you know, I mean, that's a big city. How many people are we talking about approximately?
What, is it like 13 million approximately, somewhere there?
Wow, wow. Now, how often do you see black people as you move about Tokyo?
Black people in Tokyo, man, I can go like a day without seeing a black person, or maybe even longer. Not often. It depends where you go. If I go to like maybe Shibuya or somewhere where you have more tourists or foreigners, I may run into like one and two black people, but not a lot. It's, you can go a while without seeing someone that looks like you.
Wow. Now, I mean, that's pretty broad. I didn't say how often do you bump into Jamaicans or Caribbeans or Africans or black people from the States. Just how often do you see black people in a city of millions? Like, yep. Wow, that's do you have a theory? Or let me ask this one then. So how often do you see white people?
White people. Do I see white people more than black people? I guess that's the question. Honestly, I can't even say. It might be the same. It depends where you are, though. There are some areas where, for instance, okay, like there are some areas where you see more white people. Like for instance, I tend to see more white people in the more affluent areas. Like yesterday, I was in this area. It was like an affluent area, and the whole time I saw like quite a few white people actually walking around. But I never saw any black people on the street, but where I went, there were black people there, but outside in the, just walking about, riding their bikes, I saw most of white people there. There are some areas in Tokyo as well where you would go to and you'd see more black people. Like for instance, if you go to a place called Roppongi, you'd see more black people there. Sometimes in Harajuku, you might see more black people, Shinjuku as well, Shibuya. These areas are like, you know, touristy areas. Like people usually go there because it's more, I guess, foreigners just go there because it's, you know, it's publicized. Everyone wants to go to where things are happening. It's like Times Square type vibe. But foreigners, the percentage is like literally, I think it's like what? 2% of foreigners across Japan, and I think the vast majority of that percentage are of Asian descent, right? So Asian people, so Korean, Chinese, etc., right? So so the foreigner population overall is mostly Asian, and then we have, you know, like the Caucasian, Indian people, black people, etc., but it's a very small percentage. And I guess since we're talking about this, the march that took place in on Sunday, the Tokyo Black Lives Matter march, it was mostly non-black people, from what I've seen, and other people have echoed that same sentiment. Where I was looking around, it was like from what they said, it was reported that about 3,500 people showed up, and the vast majority of the people there were non-black people. And I think that was reflective of the actual percentage of black people that reside in Tokyo or Japan, right? So I don't think it was that, you know, a lot of black people never went out. I think it's just showing you that how many, you know, black people are in Tokyo. It's a small sample size, I guess, of what the reality is. So even there were so many people, you had to move in groups, right? So I was filming it, I live streamed the whole thing. And I was looking around, and behind me there was a Japanese guy, and there was like a lot of white people behind me. I think there was a black girl actually like leading in front of me, and then but you had to look really, really hard to find a black person. And it was, to me, it was surreal to see all these non-black people holding up the sign. Like, because the thing is this, like when I was in the market, I wasn't even really paying attention to like demographics. It was immediately apparent, like you just notice. I'm like, snap, where are the black people at, right? And then so I wasn't really taking it in too deep, but when we were marching, and then they held up the sign, and was looking around, like, in Japanese, you know, different phrases in English, you know, Black Lives Matter, and all these different phrases that people had, and they were chanting. And I was looking around, and I saw, like, you know, like, white hands going up, holding the sun. I'm looking around, I'm like, snap. It was, to be honest, there was a moment there, and I'm not just trying to make this up. Like, there was a moment, that I shared this with people, where it was sort of surreal. I'm not sure what the impetus was, of course, but people have been reaching out to Black people all over, just trying to see if they can help in some way, shape, or form. I'm not sure if it's a fad or not, but I'm like, at least right now, there is some sort of interest, and I hope it's genuine and all that, authentic. But they were shouting, like, chanting Black Lives Matter and all these things. I'm like, I don't even see any Black people. All these people are saying these things aren't Black. So it was quite a surreal experience, I must say. And I think other people shared that too. It was different. There was something about it. I don't know what it is, but I'm like, there was a moment where I'm like, oh, snap, okay. Okay, I don't know what's going on here, but this is different. Yeah.
That video is on the Black Experience Japan channel. It's, I think, the most recent video up there from just a couple days ago. And I did watch it. I can confirm I watched the entire video, and from what I saw, the number, like you said, about 3,500 people, looked like they had a substantial number of folks out. And it did look like it was mostly non-Black people. As he said, he interviews quite a few folks. If you watch the video, he gets a lot of the Black people that were there, but it, I mean, overwhelmingly non-Black people out marching, the signs, the chants, all of that. You can check the video out from the channel. I will say, just being someone in Seattle, it is pretty common to see lots of non-Black people out marching and chanting. They are kind of known for doing that sort of thing here in the Seattle area, the mostly white people. In fact, they're most of the folks that are out downtown right now doing a lot of the protesting that's been going on in Seattle. You interviewed one of the folks who was helping organize the march, I guess we'll call it. You can check out that video on the channel as well. Was she one of the folks that helped organize the march you attended this past weekend?
Yeah. She was the organizer in Tokyo.
Okay. And this is a young Black lady who helped organize. Was there any danger or risk about participating, going? Like, did you feel any danger or risk being out yourself? Or was there any danger or risk about organizing this? Was this like an acceptable, yeah, let's go protest type thing?
Well, I'm not an organizer, so I'm not sure about behind the scenes. But there were people, like on Twitter, for instance, who said they were going to have, like, you know, counter protests, right? So, like, for instance, you had people, like non-Black people, who said they were going to come out and they were going to disrupt. They said that if anything happened, they would stand there to defend or whatever they said. So there were some, you know, pushback from non-Black people in that regard. But on the ground, there was nothing. But the thing that was, if you, like the Japanese commenters and stuff like that, the major concern was that COVID-19 was still, you know, running rampant. Well, it's not as bad as it was before. But they were saying that Tokyo was trying to get back to normal. Japan was trying to get back to normal. You know, they're fighting the virus and all that. And they said that if people went ahead with the march, it's just showing at this time, it's just showing that, you know, Black people, those who are participating, are selfish. And they don't care about the Japanese people's lives, because if they're saying what they're saying, they also need to be aware that, you know, Japan has a lot of old people as well. It's an aging population. And if there is a second wave, as a result of this, it just shows, you know, that foreigners are problematic and all these things. So there were, so if you look at the videos that I did, the live stream, the interview, mostly Japanese, right? So it's in Japanese, so maybe people might have to translate it or something, but the vast majority of people, they're saying that they're talking about COVID-19. They're saying they don't have a problem with the march. Some people do, but largely the most people are saying, look, man, it's the timing is off. You guys got to think about us as well when you're doing this. We're trying to get back to normal. Businesses are closed. You know, we've lost so much money. We want to get back to normal. We're working toward this thing, but now this might, ruin our efforts and just push us all the way back to the beginning of this whole thing again. So that was what was coming out. So there was some pushback on that front. Beyond that, there's nothing else. I can't recall any other. Some people are saying, well, it's Japan. Why are people protesting? It has nothing to do with Japan, whatever. But what were the most things, most of the complaints were about COVID-19.
Context of white supremacy. Our guest Ranzo joining us live from Tokyo, Japan. He operates the Black Experience Japan channel. Check it out on YouTube. They had, that should sound familiar to some folks. In fact, I've been saying like, they've been saying, they've had a number of reports, mainstream outlets saying, oh wow, the protests in the United States, could this spark a second wave, or could this spark a spike in the virus and COVID-19 in different areas where people have been out protesting for weeks now. They've been saying that, and I said that could be a part of a really racist backlash, and saying that, oh man, it's black people's fault if we have to do some sort of shutdown again, or if they say that this has messed up the economy. Exactly what he just said. We're trying to reopen and get things restarted, and now we got all this disturbance. And he didn't even mention the looting and, you know, all that property destruction that they've had here. I don't think they've had, he said, that's been peaceful, and they didn't have any of that. So yeah, that is
That you can't, in Japan is very strict, man. Like, and the organizers, they did, you know, tell everyone to make sure that it's peaceful. They even said if someone even, you know, came over and like punched someone or do something, you know, we should just like back away from the person and just, call the police to apprehend the person. There was a lot of police, actually. There was like a lot, when we were doing the march. I saw like, I don't know, definitely maybe at least 100 police at one, at this one section. Wow. That were actually there. But yeah, they said that, right? So like in Japan, no one would do that. Like that's the thing with Japan. Japan is extremely safe, and, you hardly see any type of thing like that. And that's one of the reasons why people are here, and it's no exaggeration, right? Like that's how Japan is. Like you go out, things do happen, right? Like maybe like petty crimes and stuff like that. But the crime rate, like even what do you call it? When someone lose something, I think, the rate of return of like wallets and cell phones is like what, 87% or something like that, a high percentage. But my wife lost something very valuable and she never got it back. So just to show you that, even though that's the case in Japan, sometimes you have one-off incidents, but it's very safe though. So no one is going to like do it, loot or whatever, because the thing is, anyone that does that, yeah, the Japan, their system is very good at like catching people. So if someone does that, it's like, man, you're just deporting yourself pretty much. So I think people would think twice. And then most people, again, in Japan are professionals, right? Or people are doing things. So people here generally, you know, have their head screwed on tight. You might have like a very, very small percentage of people who are crazy, but most people won't do that.
Do the enforcement officials, the police there, do they have firearms or non-lethal rounds? What do they carry?
You know what? I don't even know. I think I saw police with a gun at one point, but most of when I'm looking, I don't see a gun. But the clip that you played in the beginning of that snippet, the guy's from South Korea, actually. So when I interview people in South Korea, people are saying that the police don't carry guns and stuff like that in South Korea. But in Japan, usually what they do is, I know that they have like, you know, jujitsu and stuff like that. So they do more like martial arts and stuff to like apprehend people. So like if if a Japanese police officer is trying to stop a person that's running or something, or that's getting like, you know, like rowdy or violent or whatever, they just employ some type of jujitsu type tactic. To subdue the person. But I've seen a gun once, but I can't say with 100% certainty. But for the most part, I'll look next time I look and see, but for the most part, I don't think, I've seen them with guns. I've been stopped twice, but I don't recall seeing, any guns on them.
Very different experience on the other side of the world. But even without rounds, that's pretty, that is substantial. I would just put it this way. If I was a foreigner in somebody else's country, and particularly they're in the middle of this COVID-19 thing and they've got shutdowns and all that, and everybody is kind of looking a little side eyes at folks from different places and all that, I don't know how I would feel about protesting. And then even to go out and see 100 officers like at an intersection, like, wow, that is, that's a little tense. That's a little bit more anxiety than you would have in a typical day, I would think. But
yeah, but I think people understand the way, Japan is, for instance. Well, I think that, well, first of all, foreigners can't protest. So based on what I've heard, it's actually a march, right? So it's not like a protest, it's a march. And the thing is, well, you know, I think it would have been good to maybe at least just, to maybe make a statement to allay the concerns. But it's really mixed. I guess that's the problem, because some people have no problem with it, and some people are saying, well, the virus and thing. But that's the only, honestly, that was the only thing that they brought to the fore was about COVID-19. So I felt like that was a major concern. So in my mind, I'm like, okay, so if this wasn't the case, it seemed like most people wouldn't be saying what they're saying, because like 95% of the arguments are about COVID-19. So I think that was very telling that if maybe if that was kind of like addressed a little bit, maybe people wouldn't be talking about that so much. But yeah, but you know what? The march took place and stuff like that. But yeah, we'll see what happens. Hopefully the aftermath is good and not negative. But so far, as I said, it's mixed. People on the ground, I ask people questions. It seems like it's mixed, right? So I think that's what it is. Like everyone has something different, but it's mixed. So you'll find people for it and people against it. But I guess that's just the way it is. But COVID-19 is the main thing. Yeah.
Wow. I know they've kind of reopened things in Japan, although I did see that they're having a so-called recession as a result of how much disruption COVID-19 has caused. When did the virus get serious in Japan?
Oh man, that question. Yeah, we were on state of emergency, and they removed that, I don't know, what was it, 2 weeks ago maybe? Don't quote me with the timeline, but it was maybe 2 weeks ago. But the thing with Japan in the beginning, most people felt like the response to COVID-19 was slow, right? Because while other countries were like shutting the borders and doing all these things and testing and checking and all these things, Japan wasn't doing it. Right. So Japan waited however long. And some people were saying it was because of the Olympics, right? Because, you know, the Olympics is coming up. They were trying to delay it. And then, they canceled the Olympics, or postponed the Olympics, then we started hearing stuff. I'm like, okay, y'all just waited until, right? So that was the hold up, you know, because of the Olympics, because I was traveling during that time, because I went to Singapore. And the experience in Singapore was different from Japan. When I was leaving Japan, like, they asked me questions. Okay, have you been to China, Wuhan, this place, all these things. I'm like, nah, I haven't been there in this period of time, whatever. Boarded the flight, went to Singapore. When I went to Singapore, they asked me questions. You know, like, okay, were you here, da-da-da. When I even went to the hotel, they checked my temperature, all these things. I had to sign my temperature, sign the conscience I've been to, all these things. All these procedures that in Japan were not in effect at the time, right? So Singapore was already doing all these things when Japan wasn't even doing it. So people were saying, man, Japan's response was slow. And but the numbers here seem to be low. Some people are saying that they're like hiding the numbers or whatever. But I don't know. But so far, the numbers generally are quite low. And people have died, unfortunately. But people are saying the response was slow. And I think it had something to do with the Olympics. You know, if you can imagine, like, the amount of money they invested, like, even the train stations there changed. Like, they're constructing new, like, I think, buildings and stuff. Even Harajuku has this new addition to the station. Like, the whole place, there's so many differences. So you can imagine after investing, like, maybe, what, billions or millions of dollars or whatever, for you to just postpone something, you're going to try your best not to, to try to delay as much as possible to make that announcement. So I think that was maybe one of the reasons why.
With everything that has happened this year, I totally forgot about the Olympics. Like, that got scratched. I mean, that's a big deal. Like you said, that's billions. I think you were right the first time. They probably spent billions of dollars and all the time and energy and everything. Like, that's 4 years of planning and everything. Like, my goodness, I'm sure that was not happy day. Like, yes, we are excited. Let's scrap all this that we've been planning for the last 4 years because of this virus. And, you know, we'll see if we can pick this back up a year from now. Like, man, is it accurate? Because I've been seeing some news reports where they said Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, people are so frustrated that they think he might be in trouble. Like, this might have some political costs that enough people are upset of him not taking the virus more seriously and putting in some of those restrictions and things in place. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's accurate in terms of, even though the Japanese people overall, the younger people are not really into politics that much. I think the percentage of people that actually vote is like really low. How much is it? I think it's at under 50%, maybe under 30% or something like that. Like, it's really low. Apparently the people here aren't really interested in politics like that, right? So especially the young people. But yeah, from what I've heard, his popularity has, like, you know, fallen. Due to COVID-19. I think it has done that to a lot of people because COVID-19, man, the thing came in like a, I don't know what this thing was, man. It literally came in to disrupt the world. That's one thing I can say about that.
Wow. Do you all have folks over there? Here they're called Corona Truthers, Rona Truthers. I've shortened it to Rona Truthers, but the folks who say that this doesn't exist, that they're making this up just to cause disruption, or they got other nefarious plans, like is there a population of those folks in Japan who are like, they're making this stuff, this is a hoax, and we don't believe it?
Well, I'm not sure about on the ground, but online, of course, people have spoken about that. You know, even myself, when I heard about what was going on, I'm like, I don't know. You know, like, it just seems so strange. I don't know what the truth of the matter is with COVID-19. All I can say is when COVID-19 came out, yeah, man, it disrupted the world. But you do have people online that were saying that. Now, I don't think, is anyone still saying that? I'm not sure. But yeah, it definitely took us all by surprise. And then, you know, like, it's almost like it set us all up for the marches and stuff, right? Because from what I've been talking to some people, and it's like, if people weren't like under, on quarantine and COVID-19, it's almost set the stage for all that's taking place now, right? Because now people have to listen, people have to watch, you know, more people are watching screens now, due to COVID-19. So I think that kind of set the stage for what took place afterwards with the marches going across the world. So, you know, maybe COVID-19 maybe had some, you know, benefit or something, but I'm not trying to say it that way because I know a lot of people died. But yeah, it's been a strange year. Let me just say that. But yeah, in terms of your question, online. I haven't heard anyone on the ground, but online.
Okay. It has been the strangest of years in quite some time. Understatement. Wow. Are they, like, do you have to wear a mask? Are you wearing a mask? Like, your family, your wife? Or is it, you know, something that you always still taking?
But, you know, yeah, we do. But, you know, what happens? Because usually, look, before this, I don't wear a mask, right? I think some foreigners, usually when you would wear a mask as a foreigner, like, people would stare at you more than normal. You already get stares, right? Because, look, you're a black man, like, for instance, me, like, I'm a little tall or whatever. So, like, depending on what I'm wearing, I don't know if I look scary sometimes or not. But when I'm on the street, sometimes I get eyeballs. And when they're wearing a mask, it's like you look even stranger to people, right? So it's like, wait, foreigners are wearing masks? So usually I don't wear masks. Foreigners tend not to wear masks as much. But now it's a new thing. So sometimes I forget, like yesterday, for instance, I'm like, snap, I forgot the mask. So you leave your house and then you remember. So I'm always going out and buying masks, like a pack every time. So yesterday I'm like, I'm not going to buy a pack today, man. I'm like, you know what? I have so many packs at my house. I just put it in my bag or whatever. So when I'm out, if I forget, I just take it out and put it on. But mostly people, they ask people to wear masks now, right? Even though they're open, they're trying to open the country 100%. They ask people to wear masks. So yeah, most people do. My daughter wear a mask, my wife, myself, when I remember. But yeah, we do wear masks over here. It's not that unnatural because people in Japan always wear masks all the time. Like, it's a thing that they do. And people usually see the videos, they're like, why are they wearing masks? I see some comments where people are like, man, these people knew about COVID-19 from like early 2019. I'm like, look, this is what they do. This is what they do in Japan. You know, like, if you have like flu-like symptoms, some people, it's so many reasons. Like, one is women, it makes their faces look smaller. One is, oh, they're not wearing any makeup, they're trying to hide their faces. All sorts of reasons. Some people don't want people to see their face or their identity or know who they are. So there's so many reasons why people wear masks in Japan, but it's a part of the culture. So to them, it's normal. To foreigners, it's not that normal. So we try not wear it as much, but now I'm starting to wear it because they won't look at me strange. If I don't wear it now, they look at me like, okay, this one foreigner ain't wearing the mask. Like, why aren't you wearing a mask? You know, so it's a flip side now.
Wow. Context of white supremacy. What a year. The mask, even that, just seeing, you know, the different responses to that around the world and how that's changed. I have heard some reports where they've said, you know, because of what you just talked about, how that's kind of a part of the culture there, wearing masks, that might be one explanation or one factor as to why you all have had a lower rate of infection, whereas there's even been, there's still a substantial population of people here in the States who do not think the Rona is real, who think it's a hoax of some sort. There's still a significant population of those folks, in addition to a substantial population of people who don't want to wear a mask. Either they're just on the, you can't tell me what to do, and I don't want to do it, or I don't believe, or whatever. But there's a lot of folk, a lot of resistance to the mask. It's not a part of the culture. So that's been something that's been talked about as well. Have you been tested for COVID-19?
No, I've not. I haven't had any symptoms or anything like that. The most that happened, even yesterday, I went to a restaurant actually, and they did check my temperature, but I haven't been tested. But the thing is, a friend of mine, he lives in New Jersey. He had it, right? And there was I felt like, you know, when you feel like to call someone, but I never called him at the time when I felt like that. But when he came out of the hospital, he called me and he's like, bro, like, I was like, I went to the hospital because of COVID-19. He said he almost died.
Whoa.
So he experienced that. So I'm like, snap. So when I felt that vibe to call this guy, he was already in the hospital, right? The man is like, so he's like, look, bro, like, this thing is serious. It's a young guy too. So I'm like, look, when he said that to me, this guy's like a brother to me, right? So when he said that to me, I'm like, man, bro, snap. This thing is like serious. He's like, look, bro, like, I'm telling you, man. And he just like, you know, broke it down. And I was asking him at the time, no one was really coming out talking about what it was like. So I wanted to get him on the channel. But it was concerned about, like, you know, like, being private, you know, and stuff like that. So, and that never happened. But, like, he had a, you know, a story, and I wanted to get to the, for him to share what he experienced. But yeah, so once that hit close to home to me, right? And some people as well, you know, they tell me that family members have died. So yeah, man. So I haven't been tested because I don't have any of the symptoms or anything like that. And even in Japan too, you have to be showing certain things before, you know, you can get tested here. I'm not sure if it's this case right now, but that was a case before where if you're not showing this and that, you ain't getting tested.
Context of white supremacy. Renzo with us operates the Black Experience Japan YouTube channel. If you have questions, you want to take advantage, get some questions in to folks living over in Japan, take advantage. The number is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61. We will get you on the switchboard, get your questions in. Is your daughter, is she in school right now, or did they close the school down? Is that open back up and all? Or
Schools are open. She doesn't go all the time in terms of the days now. I think because at first when they open by the schools, I'm like, man, I don't know if I want to send her just yet. You know, I'm like, let me just wait and see what happens before, you know, before mm-hmm. I send her. So now she's going today. Like, I think, I can't remember what my wife said about the schedule, but she goes like only on certain days, during the week. But yeah, but most people like, are going back to school, right? And my wife, she teaches, right? She has to wear this mask, this type of thing. I don't know. It's a surgical mask. You know, the ones with what do you call this thing? Like a plastic guard that covers like all of your face.
Wow.
And, like a sun visor thing that comes down to like your lip or whatever, this transparent thing. And then she has to wear the mask. So it's like, it's almost like you're in like a virus type of like city, or, you know, those movies. I don't know what.
Oh yeah. Outbreak and all. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They got to wear that when they're teaching. It's crazy. But yeah, man, it's a crazy year, but yeah, I'm a bit nervous about that with her going to school, because usually, you know, when they go to school, they come back with like, you know, colds and coughs or whatever, you know. I'm just like, man, I don't know if I want to send her during this time, but she's going slowly getting back into the routine of returning to school.
Wow. I don't have children myself. I always, you know, acknowledge that, but I mean, wow. I cannot imagine, like, as stressful and chaotic as this year has been, like, for parents, like, wow, that's a whole nother layer, like, to have to think, like, do I want to send my child there? And oof, man, hope everybody stays safe. That's kind of a double whammy too, because you got your wife, she's got to go in and teach, like, man, she's got to wear that whole hazmat gear, and I'm sure she's got to have a whole code for coming in and decontaminating when she, man, woof, what a year.
You know, the worst thing about that too is that the trains in Tokyo, because people talk about all these things, but look, during rush hour, look, the trains here are like sardine tins, okay? Like, and it's no exaggeration. I'm telling you, you'll be squished in that train. So usually, you're in the train, and even sometimes I try to just use, you know, like, if I'm there, I don't want anyone to really like be like bracing upon me too much. Mm-hmm. So I try to like keep people off, but it's ineffective. You can't do it because there's so many people. And when they come in the train, people push. So there's this thing where you see the train and it's already packed. People are standing right at the door. People still push. I'm like, bro, do you see any space in this train? They just push, force their way in. And then you're against the wall and literally your face is plastered against the glass. And even during Corona, during like rush hour, it was a little bit less, but you still had shoulder to shoulder people on the train. Still, I'm like, y'all, you think this is like social distancing? This is like, there's no six, not even 6 millimeter between people. So I'm like, I don't know, but yeah, but so, you know, her going to work and different people, you gotta go on the train, right? Cause taxis in this place, man, are nuts. You cannot, if you take a taxi from where I live to where my wife worked, where you're looking at maybe, I don't know, what, $400 US, maybe? Some ridiculous price. Taxis here ain't cheap.
Wow. I don't live in like New York or the places where they have like the big sub crowded, more super populated and super crowded public transportation like that. But New York and areas like that, I can't even imagine. Like, wow. Like, I know there's some folks, you know, they don't think the virus exists and, you know, whatever, that's fine. You can have your doubts. I had my doubts as well. But even with all that, wow. Like, I am not interested in that at all. Won't be interested in that for a long time. Let's see. We'll see if they can nab a caller or two as we roll here. Our caller 9401, if you have a question for Renzo, joining us live from Tokyo, Japan. You should be with us.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, good evening, Gus. Good morning. Is it Renzo? Am I saying that right? Renzo?
Yeah, Renzo. So Ranzo, so like Renzo. So past tense.
Okay, Renzo, got it. Okay. Yeah. Okay, got it. Are you familiar with the Ainu people in Japan?
When you say anime people, what do you? I know anime, but when you say anime people, I'm not sure what you mean. But
not anime. Ainu, A-I-N-U.
Ainu. Yes, I am.
Okay. Can you talk about them a little bit and tell me how they are treated in Japan?
Okay, so just a preface. I'm not knowledgeable, like deep. I don't have a really deep understanding, so I'm not an expert on the subject matter, but from what I know, they are discriminated against in Japan. The population is decreasing dramatically. I think it was over the last decade, it's been reduced by like 50% at least, because usually they want them to assimilate. So the Ainu are, I can't remember, they came from somewhere else, different places, so their skin tone is a little bit different. They look a little bit different from Japanese, a little bit darker. Japanese people, or maybe the Yamato Japanese, like the Japanese people that most of us know about, the Ainu tend to get discriminated, because of their culture and all these things. And there's this one guy, actually, I saw a video about him. He's trying to preserve their culture because it seems like most people want them to, so you call them indigenous people. So the Ainu are like indigenous people within Japan, right? So again, they're darker, but they do face discrimination. And some people try to keep that part of their identity hidden. Because if someone finds out that you are, then you're treated differently. So they do get discriminated in Japan, unfortunately.
Thank you for your response. That's it.
No problem.
Much obliged. Let's see. Retired firefighter in Florida. Did you have a question for Renzo? You should be with us.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all of the guests and listeners around the world. Japan, Tokyo, Japan. I've always wanted to get the thoughts of someone, either who is Japanese or, in this case, a person who stays in the area, about the present day, is there any remnants of the attitude of Japan 70-some-odd years ago being occupied by white people in this part of the world? Have you witnessed or have saw maybe there's a statue of Douglas MacArthur? I don't know for sure. But is it any remnants of the occupation that took place after the battle that's called World War II that's in Japan?
Okay, in terms of like statues and stuff like that, I haven't seen any. But based on my understanding, the system itself has changed. So there's a lot of American influence, you know, within the country, the way the country has changed and is set up and all that, laws, etc. So there's that remains. But in terms, I haven't seen any statues of any, like, you know, white people or anything like that across Japan. I don't even hear people talking about even, the war that much. Only when I was in Okinawa, because Okinawa has, a large, American presence, right? There's a few bases there. There's a lot of, so that, Okinawa has, it's sort of an amalgam of the American culture, the Japanese culture, and the Okinawan culture, right? So all three. It's a unique experience. I actually love it there, actually. Because there's so many military, a strong military presence there, there sometimes seem to be, this sentiment of some people don't really like it. Some people don't want the military there. There was at one point I was there and I saw like nationalists driving around with their, like Japanese nationalists with their flags and stuff and, blaring stuff, on the streets. But beyond that, like in like mainland Japan, I haven't heard anything, but the system itself and just the way the country's run from what I've heard, is as a result of, that time. Someone told me who I can't verify or not, but this person is, he said he studied this in a university. And apparently when it comes down to marijuana, for instance, back in the day, Japan used to use it for different things. But when, American kind of came over and they were telling them what to change, they, made that illegal in Japan. So before, apparently that wasn't the case, but that was, a result of what the war, them losing the war and them just taking over and telling Japan, okay, you need to do this, you need to do that. So I think it's more so in terms of the system itself has been influenced by that than anything else.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Good. Good answers. Good answers. One more question. The science of protesting. Mm-hmm. Who do you think the protesters are? Because I've heard that the idea in mind is to inform someone. That's part of it anyway, as far as the purpose of protesting. Who do you think, in the particular case around the world, going on around the world, that in, let's say in Japan, are the protesters, or who are they attempting to inform in Japan?
Okay, so from what I've heard, so usually things that I'm not like directly like a part of, I can just talk about conversations I've had. From what I've heard, it's twofold, right? One is to stand in solidarity with people across the world so that Black Americans know that people here also support them, right? So they wanted to show support from, right, we're on the other side of the world, in the Eastern Hemisphere, so we're very, very far away. But we wanted to stand in solidarity and just show people that, you know what, we support the fight. And then the second one, based on what the organizers have said, they wanted also to open discussion about the way Black people are treated in Japan, and just have a discussion about that as well. So it was twofold, based on what they said, right? They want, so one, send in solidarity so people overseas can see that, okay, yes, Black people here and other people as well support the struggle, the fight that's taking place in America right now. And they also wanted to maybe just let Japanese people know that, look, man, even here you guys got some problems too. So that's what I've heard they've said.
Okay. Last but not least, how fluent are you in the language?
I'm not fluent yet, but I'm on my way. I'm still studying. So I'm almost there.
Right on.
All right, man.
Right on. That's it. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Did you start learning, studying Japanese before you all got there, or did you, you know, start once you got there just get with the immersion?
You know what happened? I was so in love with the culture that I studied for a year. I went to a language school and actually studied Japanese for a year. But that was in preparation to go. But the thing is, I never went. I wanted to go the following year, right? But that never happened. It was almost over a decade before I actually made my move to Japan. So when I came to Japan, I forgot most. But the thing is, you know, you never really forget a language. There's like things that just linger in your mind. And sometimes I'm like, I know that word. And sometimes I'm like, I don't know the English version, but I'm like, I know this word. So it lingers in my mind. So I had to try to like study more to try to like awaken the dead words and the dead language, I guess, in my mind. So I did that. So that's a part of my story. But people do come here knowing just very, very little Japanese. Even now, some people have been here for many, many years and they don't speak it. Some people understand it. Some people can speak it, but they can't read it or write it. I'm pretty good at like reading. I'm pretty good at like writing Japanese. I'm still working on to get my speaking proficiency to the level that it needs to be. But yeah, so for me, I did study, like I went to language school for Japanese specifically, for a year before I came to Japan, even though it was a long time ago.
Wow. Okay. Dig that. Getting more refined with language. Has anti-blackness, has that been a problem for you? I know you have several videos where some of the folks on your channel, Black Experience Japan, talk about some of their anti-black experiences that they've had in various countries, Vietnam, China. Has anti-blackness been an experience for you?
Okay, this is what I've experienced. On the trains, people do get up from beside me sometimes. And the Japanese people try to say, well, it's because sometimes foreigners wear strong cologne, or sometimes foreigners are too big. So when they sit down, they're squishing us or whatever, and so we've got to get up or whatever. I had that. I've had this one time I was with my daughter, and we were pushing the stroller. I was pushing the stroller this time. I had her, so I was pushing the stroller in the city, and I was trying to go through this the ticket gate at this train station. And this lady saw me coming from a distance with my daughter. She walked in front into the same gate as me, so we met halfway, and she wouldn't move. She would not move, and it was a good day for me though. I was in a good mood, so it took me a while to get to get to the place where I'm like, okay, I'm about to mow someone down today. But I didn't though. I didn't. I just, because I'm like, you know what, not today. So I just forced my way past her. In my mind, I'm just like, I was thinking that, I don't know what it was, but clearly she must have felt that she was better than the black person that stood before her. For her to say, well, she has the more right of way to walk through while she's seen with a daughter, a baby, because at the time my daughter was younger. So I saw that as well. And the thing with the justice system in Japan, from what I've heard, and I've interviewed someone about it as well, if you and someone here has an altercation, then, you know, more than likely you will be the person that would face in the brunt of everything, like, right? Because it's like they would, I guess from what I've heard, they tend to side more with the, you know, the native person here. But so sometimes you get into stuff like that. Me, not really. That was just one instance I had. And then maybe this one time I was walking and this dude, I was doing a live stream actually. So this guy was walking with a girl and bumped me or whatever. But sometimes you don't know if it's just a person. But for me, I do tend to have like I do have a temper a bit. But I try my best to just chill because I know that if I go to that level, it's like I got to be willing to just like, you know, just leave, right? So it's like you got to think about that. So I think a lot of people have had stuff like that where you just got to think about, okay, like, are you willing to go the extra mile, or are you just going to like let this thing slide? So I only had that one with a lady. People get up from me on the train. That hasn't happened in a while. The one dude that bumped into me, I was live streaming as well, so I was on the live stream in the middle of it anyway. So I'm just like, you know what, let me just continue what I'm doing. But I did stop. Like, I'm like, you know what, okay, let me just calm down. And then the police stopped me twice. But the thing is, I can't say anything specific as to where someone called me out. I think I was walking with my wife. I was listening to something, and she said someone was driving by and they shouted the N-word. But I never heard it because I had something on. But she said, oh, did you hear that? I'm like, oh, I never heard it. But I haven't had anything that's direct that I can say, man, this thing here has happened to me. But I've witnessed in South Korea, I was with some people, this one black guy was standing by the door of the train, and this Korean dude got up, walked up to him and pushed the guy out of the way, cussed him out, I guess in Korean, you know, telling him that he can't stand by the door. And that was a bit much for me to see that, but I don't know if I could hold it together in that, like, with that type of confrontation. But for me personally, only the things I've listed before, I can't really say I've experienced any, like, so I'm trying to really think. Maybe people just don't want to mess with me too much. I don't even know what it is. Or maybe, I don't know, I've just met some decent people. But I haven't really suffered really bad with anti-blackness. I was stopped twice. The second time I was stopped, I guess it was, I don't know why I was stopped the second time. The first time was caught on camera. So that video got like 500,000 views, cause people saw that from the beginning to the end of that one. But the second one, they stopped me. The second one was more, so it seemed that the police were fishing for something. It seems like they were more suspicious of me the second time versus the first time. But I haven't had anything that has disrupted my way of life or got me really, really, upset. The only thing about being in Japan or any country in Asia that might be problematic for black people, I think, is that you, in terms of defending yourself, that might be a problem, because it's almost like no matter what you do or what happens to you, you might suffer the consequences. So even if someone instigated something or started something with you and you wanted to defend yourself, being like an upstanding citizen, someone who, you know, you just are going about your life, you might get in trouble. So I think that's one thing with Asia so people are maybe in that sense, I think we walk as foreigners on eggshells here in that sense. So in case a crazy person tries to do something, you have to know like how to deal with that. So it's something that if anyone wants to come here, if anyone is living here, you have to prepare yourself for that. Okay, like if this happens, what will I do? So I think that's the biggest thing when it comes down to the justice system, 99% conviction rate. So I was talking to a guy yesterday. He has dreads, and he said someone just pulled his locks. Like apparently a guy saw him, and this is one thing that happens to us black people. Sometimes some people see you here, like the guys, and because you know, like black people, black men, we represent like masculinity. If people see you or whatever, they're like, oh, you know, black people are tough or whatever. People have that sense. So some people want to like test you to see how. You know, like they want to prove themselves, right? So it's like, okay, if I take on a black guy, you know, then it means, you know, I'm tough or whatever. So this one guy, apparently, this guy wanted to do that, wanted to fight the man on the train and like grabbed his locks and pulled it backwards, right? So like pulled it, and was ready to go. And the guy said he took everything within him to not respond or not defend himself. And that's one thing that I can say about being in a, I'm anti-violence, of course, but I'm pro-defense, right? I'm pro-defending yourself. I'm not the type of person to say do something to someone, but I'm like, look, if someone does something to you, defend yourself. But in Japan, it's almost like you can't, because if you do it, both of y'all are going to go to jail. You're probably going to get deported. You got to probably get to find a good lawyer, and you're going to have to pay like a ton of money as well. For instance, a guy robbed someone, a Japanese guy, and a Japanese dude saw him running and tripped him. And the guy that tripped the guy that robbed the girl's purse was also, like he was implicated or whatever, police, I think was arrested or something like that. He had to like pay for it, right? So it's like, even if you feel like you're being a hero, you know, don't try to be a hero in Japan or in these countries, because you have to pay. So I think that's one of the downsides in terms of, they're asking about blackness, anti-blackness. Maybe what I've described is anti-blackness. Some of them, I look at it as anti-blackness, like that woman, for instance, the train thing. But anything that really disrupts my way of life, nothing that I've experienced. The police don't really mess with me. I was stopped twice. That was it. In all the time I've been here, for, entered my fifth year. So yeah, I think that's a big thing though. So if you find crazy people who want to test you, that's a problem. Because I just hope that never happened to me, where someone really tried to push me like that, because I'm just like, that wouldn't be good, because I'm not about that. Yeah, I probably would get myself in trouble at that point. So that's one thing that black people got to be aware of. You have people that try to test you, and some of them know the law too, and that makes it worse. So they know the law, and because they know it and say, well, you know, they're going to side with me, they might even push it even further. So I think that's like a big thing about living in this region.
Wow. Super appreciate the detail there. In fact, as you were kind of sharing some of the anecdotes and things that have happened to you and some other folks, with the train incident, especially with your, see, that right there, that's why I always emphasize I don't have children. You know, like that's a painful situation, but I can't relate. I don't have children. That's a whole nother layer of anti-blackness and white supremacy racism, being a parent and trying to shield your child from all that, or just trying to parent within all that. But that train situation, I think Ta-Nehisi Coates has a very similar incident in his book In Between the World and Me, although his is with white women, but it's the same type of thing, trying to get on the subway and he's got his young child with him, and just the rudeness and you and your child don't matter, get out of the way type of thing. I think we read that right in Between the World and Me, Ta-Nehisi Coates. Go back in the book. Reading is super important. You also, before I even get my next question in, remind our listeners, we are giving him well wishes and sending Ranzo off with our best for his interview so he can do a great job. So he will be leaving us in about 20 minutes. So do not lollygag. Go ahead and get your hand up if you have a question that you want to get in, something you think you want to ask. We'll make sure you include. Well, you are included. You on your channel, which I also think is spectacular, at Black Experience Japan, you all include a lot of black business owners who are kind of dispersed in various Asian countries. Why do you make that such a pivotal focus on your channel?
Look, bro, I'm pro-black, man. That's the reason I do what I do, right? Because, but let me just answer the question before I give a back story. Oh, yeah, I think black businesses need support. I just did I built this app recently. It's a really basic app. It's not, it does the job, right? But it's, I guess I could shout it out. Could I? I don't know if I can.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. So it's, bejdirectapp.com. So you go there, you download the app, you install it on your phone, and it connects you with black businesses across Asia, right? And the thing is, I'm doing that for free. So no one pays me for it. I did it for free. People can put their, they can go right on it and just drop the business there. And then we review it and put it up, make sure it's like not 18 plus, et cetera. But it's there. And the thing is, I want to promote black businesses, because the thing is, I believe in that. I believe in that we need the support as a community. It's funny though, because, you know, one thing that happened with that, which I guess this is another discussion, but when I posted it on our Instagram, someone commented and she said, and this really rubbed me the wrong way, because I'm like, man, this is the mentality that I'm trying to fight. She's saying to me, tell me where the money goes. She's like, how is supporting a black business in Asia going to help the black community, et cetera, et cetera. We've got black communities right across Asia. And she's saying, are you putting the money in this, putting the money in that? But I'm like, look, if you're going to ask us these questions, I'm like, please ask. I told her that if she can answer me, if she asks every single non-black business that she supports that question, where they put their money, where their money goes, then she can ask me that question. I feel like sometimes people put things in their way just to prevent themselves from supporting their own. It's like, well, let me find a question. Do you do this? I'm like, and I'm pretty sure, because most businesses aren't black, unfortunately. And I'm sure there's some service that she uses that is not black owned, and she don't send a letter. She don't write them their thing asking them, do y'all support black this, black that? I'm like, come on now. So I'm just saying, I just said that to say just the mindset where I understand that, of course, you want black people to support black things. And I'm all for that. But I'm like, she's already coming out with a negative thing before you say, man, oh, that's cool. Or, oh, how can I support her or something? And then say that afterwards. The very first thing is you saying, nah, hold up. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, as a community, you know, we lag behind so much, because our own, we always have a problem with something. We're so critical about our own people than with other people. But anyway, so I said that. But the reason why I'm trying to promote black businesses, and I even have more episodes coming out too, with that, is because I want to promote them. And the good thing is, people reach back out to me and their business start doing really well and stuff like that. They're like, man, even during COVID-19, this is happening, that's happening. So that's what I'm about. And this, of course, no one pays me for anything. This is what I want to do. This is what I'm about. This is what's in my heart. And so the goal is just to like try to help black businesses, man, in whatever way, shape, or form I can. And I think we need the help. So if I have a platform and I can help, so this is all. So I started this black business segment that we're doing now. So we'll be featuring black businesses during those segments. So that's where my heart is, man.
Absolutely love it. That is spectacular. And unfortunately, and I make sure I get this in, That is a result of white supremacy racism. At least that's my conclusion. When victims of racism, black people, have those type of responses, like, where's the money going? Not that those are incorrect questions, like, to ask, but man, like, do you ask these questions like all the other businesses that you patronize throughout your day, throughout your life? Like, we have bought a lot of things, iPhones and sneakers. Like, you go to Whole Foods, do you ask them where do they invest? When you get on Southwest Airlines, do you ask them where do you invest? Like, I've heard that from a...
Yeah, you have to ask that question, man. I'm like, there's no way. You have to. I'm like, no, you have to. If you don't do that, if you do that with them, I'm like, cool. But if you don't do it with a white person or some Asian business or some other businesses, why would you ask a black person that? It's almost like you're finding a reason not to support it. You want to find something why. Okay, let me see why. I don't know, man, but that's something that, you know, we need to handle, man. We need to handle that. We need to handle it, man. If we need to move forward, man, bro, there's so many things, but that's one of them. And I'm all for promoting black businesses, and it's, yeah, man. So many stories, bro. So many stories. I guess another one real quick. There was in Canada, for instance, well, my clientele, for some reason, I'm not sure why, but I just think it might just be because we're B2B. It was mostly like, you know, like white people, Asian people. I did have some black clients, but not a lot. But even in Japan and other places, for some reason, I'm not sure why this is the case. Let me know if you've experienced this in the States, where some of the owners, they say to me, man, sometimes, you know, people who you expect to support you, like black people, they don't show up. And they're like, I don't know, man, like, I don't know where the black people are. For some reason, I can count this amount of time on my hands where, you know, some of these people come, or that happened, or that happened. Why do you think that is? I guess this is probably going to take too much time, but it seems to be a thing where black people don't support other black people or black businesses for some reason. I'm not sure why, but it seemed like to be a thing that black businesses suffer from.
We have talked about that before. I say again, the system of white supremacy, it has an impact in so many different ways. Like, we have heard from some black people. In fact, Carter G. Woodson, he wrote about it in The Miseducation of the Negro. I play that sound clip when we do our weekly program on workplace racism, where he talks about, because of white supremacy, sometimes that there's a lot of jealousy and we get upset about seeing another black person being successful. And certainly white people do a lot to sabotage black businesses. They've been talking a lot about Black Wall Street the past few days, and that is a sterling example of white people sabotaging those efforts. But I mean, there's so many things. They were talking in Chicago. They were talking about the protests and the COVID-19 situation. And they said in Chicago, businesses had invested, I think, more in one white neighborhood than they did in all of the black neighborhoods in Chicago. So they're like, there's so many. Even for me here in Seattle, we have a very low population of black people, like less than 10% of the population of Seattle, Washington is black. But there are black people here. I'm here. There are other folks, even black people that migrated from the continent. There are a lot of different African-owned businesses and other black people that have businesses. A lot of times, most of their customers are white people. Now, for an environment like this, it would have to be that way. Like, I don't know if they could stay in business if it was just black people. But yes, that is a frustration that we have talked about regularly. And that's why I super appreciate your special effort at promoting black businesses and having your app and making that a central focus with the channel to promote folks. And then to hear especially that, hey, black entrepreneurs are saying, hey, you got me on Black Experience Japan, and we got a boost in sales even during the COVID situation and all that. So, I mean, that is working against racism right there. Black self-respect to support black businesses.
Yes.
What is the plan? Like, you've been there 5 years, basically, 5 years this summer. Like, are you all hanging out indefinitely, or, you know, you going back to Jamaica at some point?
You know, people keep, some people ask the questions. Not a lot of people ask that question. But the thing is, I'm always a Jamaican, right? But I actually moved from Jamaica, so Canada is now my home, right? So, like, Canada, that's where my daughter was born and stuff like that. Maybe at some point I might go back to Jamaica, but if we move back from Japan, I'm thinking maybe we spend a season in Jamaica, but the plan is to go back to Canada. Whenever that is, I'm not sure. So I'm saying if we do go back, Canada would be the place that we would return to. But yeah, so in terms of being here right now, we're just, I guess taking it one day at a time and seeing what happens, because the plan wasn't to be here this long, to be honest. And the thing is, that's a common story. Like, I've interviewed so many people, and I had conversations with so many people off camera as well. And people who come here, people tend to come here for a short period of time, 1 year, 2 years, and they end up living here for the rest of their lives, like 20 years, 10 years, 15 years. Those stories are so common. So it seems like we might have fallen into that same thing, I guess, the allure of this experience in Japan, has caught us, right? It has captivated us in a way where we have extended our stay in Japan. And so I can't say when our departure will be, but it's almost like now we have a mission, right? We have this mission that we're on. When I started this thing, I never knew that this thing would have, become what it is today. But it's one of those things where I just followed my heart, and I've been that type of person, right? So, I'm just following my heart and the thing that I believe, is very close to my heart when it comes down to black people and trying to change the image that the media tries to portray. I think it's something that needs to be done. And thank God we do have, some influence and the reach and attention now where we can actually put some stuff out that can actually connect with people. So I'm appreciative of that. So because that's what we're doing now, because look, bro, I left a business in Canada. Like, I'm not even joking. Like, I left it was a growing business. We were making money. Even the day when I left, even when I came to Japan, we had orders still to fulfill. Okay, 1 year, but, I love that business to sort of like die, so to speak, just to continue. And the thing is, I never even started BG at that point, but my plan was to come here for a year. And then, I was doing good. I loved what I was doing. It was the best. I think it was my first business, actually. And it was the first time. And I realized the difference between working for someone and working for yourself. And I'm like, man, I can never go back to working for another person. After like seeing what the other side looks like, so I was like, man, so I encourage people to try to like go down that road. I know it's not easy because at the time when I left my job, my daughter was literally just born. Like, so she was young. So my parents were like, yo, what are you doing? Are you crazy? You know, I had a wife. You understand? And like, yo, what are you doing, man? But I'm like, man, you know what? This job, it was a good job, but man, I hated this job. And, I did it and thank God it worked, but I left all that. And came here, and I think it was maybe destiny, because I think this is more important than whatever it is what I was doing. So that wasn't the plan. The plan was to come here, explore, travel, see what Japan was like, and go back and just do the business and open up a store, blah, 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 blah. That's not the case right now, right? So I just went with it. Yeah.
Wow. Right on. That's what you have to do. Sometimes you get those signals from the creator about how you should be using your time and energy. And sometimes you have to have the courage to listen and take heed. Again, we have Mr. Renzo be with us for about 10 minutes. We will wish him well for his interview. So if you have a question, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. You talked about wow. So you'd be going back to Canada, not Jamaica, if you were leaving Japan. And you said the plan wasn't even to be there for 5 years, and you all have got caught up in the allure and enjoyment of being in Japan. One thing I've noticed also on your channel is at least the idea to get black people elsewhere, the States or wherever they happen to be, to at least consider, like, venture out. Like, there are other places you could check out, call home, hang out, and be able to. The theme came out a lot in that clip about feeling safer, black people feeling safer who are outside in different parts of the world, Vietnam, China, that sort of thing. What has been the allure that has allowed you all to be there for now five, indefinitely, we'll say? What has been so cool about your time there?
For me personally, right? Me and my family?
Well, you got to give us a little of both, because, yeah, you're a dad, you're a wife, a husband, yeah.
Okay. For us, coming out here, the thing is this, Canada, okay, I grew up in Jamaica, right? And Jamaica is a tough country, it's rough. It's a country where it's still, like, there's a lot of fun. Like, Jamaica is a place where you can always have fun, people party, and you got that vibe. There's always a vibe. But at the same time, it's a country where it's rough, right? The crime rate is quite high in Jamaica. When you're on the street, you have to be, you have to have your guard up at all times. If you're on the street, you just got to be ready to go, like, every second. Like, you literally cannot relax. The moment you do that, you might get caught up in something. So I know that very well. Coming from that type of environment and then moving to Canada, the first thing I noticed with Canada was, snap, you know, this place is, you know, quiet. This place is clean. I felt safe even in Canada, right? Because I'm even, I would go to like the, what you call the inner city communities. Those would look like, upscale neighborhoods if it was like Jamaica. I'm like, snap, this isn't what you call a ghetto in Canada? I'm like, hold up. I'm like, what's going on here? So I had that feeling, that vibe there. And then when I came to, there's similarities between Canada, I believe, and Japan. So when I came to Japan, Japan was, you know, as clean as Canada, right? It felt as safe as Canada, where I was in Canada. So I guess that's not that different, but I feel like in Japan, for me and my family, it's a perpetual adventure because it's a new culture altogether. You can't learn everything. There's something new almost every single day to discover, to try. You know, like, you can travel to the different prefectures. You can try different foods. You learn something different. You can travel to other countries around here. It's safe. You don't have to worry about, you know, like, it's really safe. Like, you don't hear about people being shot and killed, anywhere. So you hear some crime, but it's not just some one, two things, but nothing major, man. So it's a place where you feel, if you look in the future, you can say, okay, you know what? I can raise my family here. And I don't have to worry about, you know, something happening to one of them when they're outside. You as a black person too, you might even live longer, you know, because the fear of being shot by the police or being shot by anyone else or anything like that is not really there, right? Anything is possible still, but it's like the probability is a lot lower than anywhere else in the world. So it's like when you look at it, you consider all these things, the quality of life. You know, if you have a decent job, and usually if you're here and you're working, like, the job is at least a little bit decent, so you can, you know, you can pay your bills, even though the taxes are quite high, but at least you can pay your bills, you can live, right? So it's a place that is comfortable. You have that peace, that serenity. You go to a Japanese garden, man, it's so quiet. You're looking at the water, the lake, the trees. It's just a beautiful place in terms of that. And the culture is a very rich culture. And so you don't feel like, oh my God, someone's going to, you know, you're going to lose this. If you leave your door open, you lost something. So all those things combined, it's a place where you feel like, you know, you can raise your family, and it's a pretty good place, right? So I think, in that sense, of course, you got the dark side of Japan as well. Like, when it comes on to, ijime, or like bullying and different stuff like that, that exists within the society. And even some of the things I talk about when it comes on to, if you need, you know, to defend yourself, or if certain things happen like that, there's still all these things. And the criminal justice system, there are things that need to be worked on. But for the most part, if you are a decent human being, you can live a decent life, a good life, depending, and you're fine. So I think the things that people want, for the most part, as foreigners, right, because it might be a different experience for the Japanese people, but as foreigners coming from somewhere else, it represents a different experience. It represents what a lot of people have been looking for. So, like, when I interview black Americans and I talk with them, it's like when they compare the experience of being in America, when it comes down to the probability or the likelihood of being shot, or just the way they feel there, when they come here, it's like a weight has been lifted off their shoulders, right? They feel like they're treated more, and even myself as well, as, you know, just another person walking the street, for instance. And that's just the way it is. It's usually Japanese foreigners. So whatever foreigner you are, that's what it is for the most part. But of course, you do have some races that may have some advantages in some areas, depending. But for the most part, it's like Japanese and foreigners. But all things considered, it's a decent place to live. You get a job, you're fine. You know, you make a little money to take care of your family. You're safe. You can go out and explore, try some new food, go to somewhere else and visit, go to an onsen. I'm not really into the public onsens because I don't want people to be staring at me or whatever. But you can do all sorts of things. So I think that's the allure, man. With all those things, what people want, you can get it here for the most part, if it remains like the way it is right now.
Let's see. Non-Clemson grad. And Miss C. Did you all have a question?
Yes. Ogenki desu ka?
Ogenki desu. Hai genki desu.
Yes, I've been studying Japanese for about one and a half, two years myself. I hope to one day go to Japan myself, though personally I do worry about the idea of what kind of anti-black racism I might come across. Because recently my wife and I, we went to India about a year and a half ago, and we had a pretty okay time. But there were certain situations that were quite questionable. But it seems from what you've been describing so far, at least compared to your experience in Jamaica and what you hear coming out of the States, it just basically feels safe is what I'm getting from what you're saying. Like, even with all the things you understand that's happening in the world, it just, even with all the racism you know that exists, you just feel safe in Japan. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and even this is another thing I just thought about as well. You know, when you go to a store, because look, my parents live in the States, my brother is in the States, my brother's in university in the States. I got family. I spend time in the States too. But what I'm saying is that, you know, the vibe, the feeling you get when you go to a store, and you feel like people might be watching you, or when you're buying something, you want to make sure that you leave with something because you don't want someone to think you're shoplifting or whatever. In Japan, that doesn't look. You go into a cab, you go to a store, people give you jewelry to try on right there. You go in, you take up whatever, you walk around in the store with something. No one is going to watch you. No one's going to walk behind you. Like, bro, like all those things that we're used to from the West, like it doesn't happen here. I've heard like maybe one guy said someone was watching him at one point, but for the vast majority, you can just walk around in the most expensive store. You go into whatever store name brand you want. You ask for shoes to try on. People just deal with you just as a customer. There's no, hey, can you afford that? Hey, no, there's nothing like that. Like, I've never experienced that. You can walk into, as I said, go wherever you want to go. You're cool. For the most part, right? So all those things, you don't get that vibe. You don't feel like, man, I got to like prove that, okay, I can afford this, or, oh, are they going to think I'm going to try to like, are they thinking that I'm going to try to rob this or steal this or whatever? I've never felt that vibe here. So that's one thing. You feel as you should feel. All the things that people want to feel, you feel that when you're here. So that's a good thing.
Okay. That's interesting. How about this? Let's see, you know, obviously you've been there for about 5 years, you say, almost 5 years, and you're out, well, to be someplace for 5 years means you have to be working. And, I think you said something along the lines of, you know, African Americans in particular, I mean, if they could afford to make such a trip, that they should definitely try to travel more. So let's assume that, you know, black people hear something, some of the stuff that you're saying, and they decide to themselves, they want to move to Japan. Is it reasonable for them to expect to come to Japan and be able to make a life there? For example, be able to get a job and raise a family. Like, for example, I have degrees in engineering and urban planning, but, you know, suppose someone who doesn't have a degree, if they come over there, can they make a living?
Okay. So this is not just for African Americans, just people over black people overall that want to come, if they want to come. The thing with Japan is there are different ways to get to Japan, right? But one of the biggest things, a degree and associates at the minimum, for most jobs. People have secured jobs in Japan without degrees, but that's not the norm. But the easiest way, as you said, right, and the reality is, well, they're trying to do this thing to get more low-skilled workers, but I'm not sure how that's going. And from what I've heard, they're trying to get more Asian type people for those positions. From what I've heard, don't quote me, but I know there's some talk about some low-skilled workers, right? And the Japanese people aren't really for it for various reasons. They feel like they might abuse them, etc. But most jobs here, a degree is required. English teaching, for instance, the minimum is an associate's degree. Most people have at least a bachelor's degree. So that usually is if you want to come here to live, right? So if you want to work, that's the easiest way. Some people can also come as a student, right? You can come and study Japanese if you want. It might be a little bit easier, to do that. We have some videos coming out that will, you know, give people some information. But if you come as a student, that's another way as well. But that's the thing. If you're an American, you can come in for 3 months and just, explore the country. The thing is, the degree part is like the biggest hurdle, I think, for people. Cause some people do reach out and they're asking me, if they can come without it. The thing is, I believe anything is possible. Right, so someone could travel to Japan if they want to experience it for 3 months. If you have like an American passport or maybe a Canadian passport or some other passport like that, you can come here for 3 months. You can see what it's like. Come with a little money. You know, maybe you can start to connect with some people. Try to reach out to some jobs, apply or whatever, and see what might happen. Because it's usually easier sometimes if you can connect with people inside the country than outside the country. But as you said, to live, it might be a little bit more challenging. It's possible because I know people here who have done it, but they came as entertainers, right? And usually it's a company that sent for them, right? So a company would say, okay, I want you to be like a dance instructor, or I want you to be, you know, this type of person, something in the arts. And then that's a way into Japan. But the fact of the matter is, if you don't have a degree, and you're coming by yourself, it's really, really hard, to make the transition into being here long term without that. So that's the reality right now, though. That's the only thing. In terms of making a life, as you said, it's possible for people to make a life if you have a job in Japan. Like if you get any job as a foreigner, you can make a life, right? You get a place. It's fine. It's expensive, but you make enough money, I believe, to live a decent life, and you don't have to suffer and struggle like some other place in the world.
That answered your question, non-Clemson grad, yes?
Yeah, that answers my question. Thank you very much.
Awesome. No problem. Yeah, I know it's a big thing, man, with a degree. I know it's a big thing, but yeah, that's the reality, right? It's possible, associates at the minimum, but I know a lot of people reach out there saying, I don't have this, I don't have that, how can I do it? There might be ways, and I know there are ways, but it's not something that's, I guess, really publicized, or I'm not sure of any direct channels. But I would say to people, still just, you know, travel, man. If you can come over here, just visit and see what it's like, see how you feel, and maybe, you know, you might get lucky. You never know.
The YouTube channel, The Black Experience Japan, go check it out and subscribe if you are thinking about relocating, or at least visiting. Maybe you're not even thinking about moving permanently, but at least visiting and doing some traveling. Once all this settles down, you can visit the channel, get information. If you're thinking about relocating, lots of information. If you have questions and what have you, check it out, post. I'm sure some folks will respond. But The Black Experience Japan, ran by our guest Renzo, thoroughly enjoyed having you as a guest on the program. We will wish you great fortune at your interview coming up in a few minutes. I'm sure it will work out well. And keep up the spectacular work, your focus on black businesses. Just thankful we could have you on the broadcast this morning, sir.
Thank you so much for having me, man. I appreciate it.
For sure. Take excellent care, and we will speak soon, sir. Sayonara.
All right. Kiyosukete. Bye.
Context of White Supremacy. Frenzo. Make sure you subscribe, The Black Experience Japan. Subscribe, check out the videos. Like I said, they have videos on the protest, March. That words are important. The march that took place this past weekend, how they're dealing with COVID-19 on that side of the world, racism in general, anti-blackness. Check out the channel, The Black Experience Japan. Subscribe. Oh, wow. We will be here tomorrow for the book club, Ta-Nehisi Coates. Sorry, got Ta-Nehisi Coates on the brain. Mentioned him earlier. I'm going to have to double check to make sure that I was correct with my assessment. I think there is a incident, because it's been like 5 years since we read Between the World and Me, but I think it's an exact incident where he's on the train in New York and some race soldier like shoves him or is rude when he has his child with him. Anyway, we will be here tomorrow not reading Ta-Nehisi Coates. We'll be reading Fred Jerome and Roger Taylor's Einstein on Race and Racism. This is a book Dr. Welsing recommended specifically, I think in 2014. She was on this program, like she recommended it specifically. And it's within the broader framework of her recommending that we study Nazi Germany. This book is basically a compilation of Albert Einstein's like letters, commentary, talking to like his contemporaries his thoughts on white supremacy racism. Like it talks about the relationship that he had with W.E.B. Du Bois, the relationship that he had with Paul Robeson. There are even pictures of them together. We just read the biography, Dr. Gerald Horn's biography on Paul Robeson. But these one of them is black, one of them is white. So I believe it's Roger Taylor is black male, co-author of this book, and Fred Jerome, white male, co-author. But I believe they have like photographs of Paul Robeson and Albert Einstein together. And I think that they talk about the reason that they put this book together was that this type of material, like what Albert Einstein had to say about racism and his comparisons to Nazi Germany and it, like him, his relationship to Paul Robeson, his relationship to W.E.B. Du Bois, that all of this is redacted from the typical biographies and commentary on Albert Einstein. And I think the white author, co-author, Fred Jerome, I think that he had written and done other work on Einstein, and when he started coming in contact with this material, he was stunned, like, whoa, what's going on here? And the other immediate question is, why hasn't this been included? Like, why would this be left out? Because he said there's so many biographies and papers on Albert Einstein. He's one of their revered white scientists. Why wouldn't this be included when people talk about his legacy and his life and what he did? Especially like Paul Robeson. And, like, these are not, you know, shiftless nobodies. And then he goes on. This is the white co-author. He goes on to say that he started to try to get this information published. Like, before he had the book, he started doing like little articles and such on, you know, what Einstein had to say about racism and his connection to W.E.B. Du Bois. And he said that he would submit it, you know, to be published, and he wouldn't hear anything. And then he said other times people would respond and be like, oh, yeah, we don't dig all that up, you know, just rile everybody up and cause a big fuss. And he said that kept happening. Like, hey, like, what do you mean? Like, this is important. Like, this is one of the most revered scientists in the world, certainly of the 20th century. Like, why would we be leaving this out? He had so many things. It's not like he just made one comment about racism. Like, he talked about it and talked about it and talked about it. And, you know, it's talking to W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson and all these for, like, you know, why would this be left out? Deliberately left out. Can't forget that word. Deliberately redacted. Why would that? And systematically, like, not just in one biography they don't mention it, but like across the board. Why would this be unilaterally left out of the body of study on this man? The system of white supremacy. But again, Dr. Welsing told us directly on the program. I'm trying to go back and make sure I get that sound clip directly, because she had, you know, quite a bit to say about this book specifically, and said, oh yeah, you should read it. You should read it. Reading is more important than watching television. I'm pretty sure she slipped that quote in too. But that's the book we'll be reading. I know I'd said last week we were going to do Dr. Huey P. Newton's Revolutionary Suicide, which was the plan. But retired firefighter scared me so when he said that this book, they used to read it and it was required, and that he thought it came out, was published around the same time, the 1980s, when he was a member of the African Liberation Army, and they were running around talking about how dumb and stupid and ignorant white people were. It frightened me so that I said, oh no, we can't have another month or 2 months of that. Like, I would go loony. And so I do want to be very clear. I did begin going through and reading to see if that was the case, and I don't think that's the case. I didn't see any commentary about dumb white people, stupid white people, nutritional Uncle Toms, none of that. But our narrator, Mel, she read the autobiography for Asada Shakur. She read Neil Postman's Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk. She was all set to go. I think she had even read like the first three or four chapters of Revolutionary Suicide, which is important. She had already read the first three or four chapters of Dr. Newton's work, which is what we were going to go with. But I gave her that book because I was thinking of that book Einstein on Race and Racism, and William Darity's Sugar Blues, which was referenced in Dr. Africa's book, and we had already done a book review of that book before. We just didn't do it in the book club. So I gave her all three, and I said, you pick which one you think would be most important for what is happening right now, June 2020, middle of the protests and the coronavirus. After reading those first, I think, four chapters or so of Dr. Newton's book, she said, this reminds me quite a bit of Asada Shakur's autobiography, which she narrated. I think, you know, this doesn't seem unfamiliar for people. Like, if you've been in the book club or if you've been studying racism, white supremacy this period of time, like, a lot of this information isn't, like, strange. You'll get a lot more detail about Dr. Newton specifically and, you know, how he arrived at this conclusion, his childhood and life experiences. So if you want more details on him specifically, she was saying, especially the first portion of the book, that's what a lot of it's about. But it doesn't seem like it would be totally new. She said she was very hooked with the Einstein on Race and Racism, and she just heard Dr. Welsing remind us that we should read this book specifically, so she was all in, especially when she got some of the correspondence between he and Dr. Dubois and Paul Robeson. So, yeah, and in fact, there is a C-SPAN video with the co-authors, Fred Jerome and Roger Taylor, where they're talking about the book, and it's fascinating, just going into some of the details. In fact, I can give you one snippet. They, W.E.B. Du Bois, this is in the 1950s, was apparently arrested, George Floyd style. He was arrested, and they hauled him into court. Forgot what the charge was, being some sort of outside agitator. I think that was pretty close to it. Said he was an outside agitator type person. So they haul him into court. He's, I think, 87 at the time that they haul him into court. And so Albert Einstein is going to testify on behalf of Dr. Dubois. And the defense attorney for Dr. Dubois makes this known to the judge that Albert Einstein is going to be witness for the defense, and they find this out and dismiss the charges. Powerful white man. But I was hooked. Like, even before it got to that point, I was like, wow, this is such a fascinating book. I can see the grandcestor. The grandcestor. I can see why she would say, oh, yeah, you should get that there book, Einstein on Race and Racism. I don't know if it's very difficult to get or not. I got it, but it's only because I had that book, like I had it years ago. I got it when she said it, even though I didn't read it immediately when she mentioned it, but I still had it from when I got it years ago. So I don't know, you know, if the libraries are open or what the deal is. It shouldn't be too hard to find, I don't think. You know, they did a report on C-SPAN. It's not like obscure literature, but the C-SPAN video I did post online, social media and what have you. You can check it out. You can just put in Einstein on Race C-SPAN and it'll pop up. It's like an hour. It's very interesting, and I am looking forward to the book starting it tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I'll check in to see if folks have any thoughts about our guest, Renzo, joining us live from Japan. I just want to point out, I thought it was very important what he said. The black business component, super critical. He has a lot of content. You can go to Black Experience Japan on YouTube, and you'll see the content on black businesses. And he does a lot of great work promoting black entrepreneurs, not just in Japan, but throughout so-called Asian countries. Check it out, Black Experience Japan. But I thought what he said was really important about those protests, where he said it seemed like the only real gripe about the or march sorry it's not a protest it is a march not a protest a march so it seemed that the only real gripe about the march was that the virus, that folks over there are taking the virus serious, and they just had the shutdown, and they're saying Japan is in a recession, so they did not want this to disrupt anything or to cause any future problems. He said, in that vein of thinking, that if it looks like they do have some sort of second wave or anything like that, it could be where they end up, you know, blaming the protesters. He said blaming black people specifically, which I thought was important because he had already said there aren't really a lot of black people in Japan. it's pretty homogenous society, as they say. And as he said, and as the video, it's not just as he said, the video, it's like 2 hours of streaming footage that he has. You can go check it out. It was mostly non-black people at the protest. It's not like, you know, they imported O.J. Simpson and a whole lot of black folks from Nigeria and the U.S. to come over there and get rowdy and chant slogans. These were non-black. I guess most of them would have probably had to be Japanese people. I don't think it was a whole lot of white people. I did see some, but would have probably had to be a lot of so-called Asian people out there marching. But if this, you know, ends up causing a second wave or a spike and the virus gets out of control and we have to lock things down again, man, black people messed everything up for everybody like they always. Global system of racism, white supremacy. But I thought that was important because I said the same thing could happen here. They end up saying, oh man, we got a second wave and it's the niggers' fault that George Floyd, even dead niggers causing us all this prop. I could see that happening, having what they call it a racist backlash. Oh yeah, I could see that happening. Anywho, folks have any thoughts that they would like to share, questions, feel free. Global system of racism. Always think it's important. We'll have our Global Sunday Talk this coming weekend, this Sunday. Think it is super important to be able to check in with black people or just non-white people, period, around the world to get more information about the COVID-19 situation, about racism in general. Very important to be able to exchange views. Folks have anything they want to make sure they get in?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida.
Yes, sir. I would participate, would I try to anyway, with any book reading that we have. But I don't recall stating that about Huey Newton that he was saying that white people were dumb and you know, that sort of thing. I don't recall me saying that.
Oh, you didn't. You didn't.
Okay. I did. I said I did say I read the book, you know, but I can't remember a lot. And I was preparing for it by doing some reading on it. And just like I think I heard you say that, basically what it is, it's his autobiography, and he's also was espousing some of his philosophical thoughts, you know, that sort of thing. And that's about it. But yeah, the book with that Dr. Welsing recommended, that's cool with me. Looking forward to it. I just don't have it, but I would participate with it. Yeah, I was just thinking because I do say a lot of things that I sometimes forget. But I was thinking to myself, I don't recall stating that. But anyway, yes, thank you.
You are correct, retired firefighter. He did not say that there's any mention of white people being stupid and ignorant in Dr. Newton's work. He did not say that. He just said that it was published around the 1980s, around a similar time period, as I said, when he was doing some of his white people are stupid and antics rhetoric of that time period that we just read. He said it was published in the same time period. And I said that alone was enough to have me a little frightened, like, uh-oh, I hope that rhetoric is not going to be in the book. And just as he said, it is
not. No, I like it from the standpoint of, you know, if one likes to read autobiographies and whatnot, he was basically talking about Huey P. Newton. That's what he was talking about for the most part, you know, so far that I've read, you know. And, you know, I mean, it would be an easy, quote unquote, easy read. You know, when you got something like autobiography, person is talking about themselves, you know. And but I agree with Mr. Fuller. I think I've heard him say that, you know, a lot of times, even with autobiographies, they're not accurate. They're not necessarily accurate all the time, you know. So, you know, take it as that. But anyway, I think the other book probably more scientific in regards to what your program is designed to do. So I'm cool with it.
I think I would have enjoyed Dr. Newton's book. I don't think I would have griped. It's, you know, pretty much what he said, I think, just kind of going over his life and times and how he arrived at some of his theories on racism and all that. Like, it seemed like it would have probably been constructive. So nothing bad to say about that work.
Yeah.
The only reason for the switch, and really I think the reason for the switch is, Dr. Welsing did recommend this book specifically. That was why I brought it up, you know, to begin with. And,
I recall her saying it. Well, I recall her saying it.
She mentioned it specifically by name, author, and she had quite a bit of enthusiasm about saying, you know, we should, I'm going to have to make sure I go back and find that snippet, because I thought it was, that's how I got the book, that's how I know about it. She mentioned it specifically, and I went and, you know, got it. I just was too lazy to read it immediately. But that was one. And then, several. Two, she had already said study Nazi Germany. Einstein had come here right after leaving Berlin, fleeing. And she used to mention that all the time, Dr. Welsing did, that he had all this genius, but he didn't focus that genius on the problem, the system of white supremacy, racism. And he almost died, had to run for his life to get away from Hitler's Germany. So she always mentioned that. So that's two. She said study Nazi Germany. This would be a good time because it seems like there are a lot of parallels. She said end-stage white supremacy, fascism, end-stage white supremacy. That was what she said. Three, this is kind of novel. Like, I think, you know, we have programs on the Black Panther Party before and all of that. I don't think we have done any programs on Albert Einstein, even though he's such a, you know, lauded figure and discussed pretty regularly. So it's a tad novel, and particularly even beyond that, like, I think most of the according to the authors, most of the conversations on Einstein are not about his views on racism. So, yeah, this will be novel in a lot of approaches. He's still a suspected racist, as I have seen reports about, you know, different things that he allegedly did or said that were racist. So still a suspected racist, but all of this will be novel. Be the first that I've heard of it. Like, if you had told me Albert Einstein and Paul Robeson hang out together, I would have probably not been thinking that. Or did Albert Einstein come to testify or agree to testify on behalf of W.E.B. Du Bois? Like, I would, or at least I would have been ignorant about all of that. So hopefully after we read this book, we won't be ignorant. We'll see if we can help use that, incorporate that, and how we go about solving this problem. Any other comments folks have, what they heard from my guest, Black experience in Japan, the operator Ranzo just hung out with us.
Yes, my question to him about the occupation is, for my own understanding, to see whether or not on how he would answer it in reference to you know, a lot of places where the white supremacists have been, including Japan, that they leave statues and, you know, the different remnants of their power. And I see to whereas, based on his answers, that he said that they weren't. But I would say probably that example, it wasn't in statues, but it's probably is in the reconstruction of Japan. As far as some people say, Japan looks like New York or something, you know, something like that. You know, and I do know that white male by the name of Douglas MacArthur, who ruled for about maybe 5 or 6 years, I think, just almost totally renovated Japan to make it look like a place where white people stay at during that period of time.
I've never been to Japan or anywhere in the Eastern Hemisphere, for that matter. Hawaii is as close as I've gotten, but I am sure, and I've heard that before, the critique that he just raised. I have been to New York, that at least parts of Japan look similar to New York in terms of the architecture and the design, that sort of thing. The influence of white supremacy racism takes a lot of different forms. He even said that. I think he said some of the areas that are closer to where some of the military bases are, you can see more of that influence. So, yeah, and that's in Hawaii, too. You can see where, oh, the military bases. Yes, the military might of white supremacy racism is ubiquitous. But I will say his comments about feeling safer, I guess, that's, you know, not to be minimized. And I suspect, I wish I had got this in because I had that down. Now, he lives in Tokyo. Now, he said that's, you know, big talk about New York, big massive city and millions of people piled up on top of each other, canned in like sardines in the subway, on the train and such, he said. If you're out in the more rural areas, I suspect that's a totally different experience. Like, I wish I had got that in. Like, what is rural Japan like? You know, when you're hanging out, and it's quiet. You don't have all those skyscrapers and taxis and traffic and noise and all the rest of it. Like, what is that experience like where you can just go out and peaceful, you know, whatever, live in the, like, you know, I'd be curious about that, but I'm sure that is a substantial impact. That might be like a part of the allure that he talked about, where you can, because I think he said that you can just have a safe life. You can have a high quality of life. You're safe. I've meant to ask him that about universal healthcare too. I had those down on my list and just didn't get it in, but, to just be able to be safe, probably got pretty good schools and such. Seems like they're taking the Rona somewhat seriously. He said his wife, she teaches in school, and she's got a whole hazmat uniform that she's got to wear, and masks and all the rest of it. So I can see that if it's, you know, feeling as though there's less of a threat of imminent violence against you, like you're not going to be accosted. You don't have to feel like if you go out, a random white person is going to, you know, do you some harm, or enforcement officers are going to stop and molest you and take an hour out of your day and all the rest of it. I can totally see how, wow, like a massive improvement. Like, even if I get a few odd looks from time to time, and, you know, they don't want to sit next to me on the train, and, you know, whatever else, little anti-blackness, I was going to say inconveniences, don't minimize, other instances of anti-blackness, even with that, wow. This is safer. He said that's what's up. This is a safer environment. I enjoy it. He talked about all the, you know, the architecture. You can go out in the Japanese gardens and all that. But I mean, that's a, they have Japanese gardens here. They got those right in the city where I live at. You come to Seattle, we can go to the Japanese gardens. It's right in the middle of Seattle, right where they, matter of fact, you could walk to it from where they're protesting. I'm sure it's a substantially different experience being at the Japanese gardens in Seattle, being at the Japanese Garden in Tokyo, or particularly out in rural Japan. Let's see. Any other folks, any other thoughts, what they heard from Ranzo joining us from Tokyo?
One last insight. Well, two that I got from Mr. Fuller about his experiences with Japan. When he went, I think it was in the 1950s, and he mentioned about how kind the people were. He didn't know the language or anything, and some Japanese guy was carrying around his luggage, you know, taking him where he needed to go, that sort of thing. One last thing that Mr. Fuller brought to my understanding is that everywhere the white supremacists go in terms of negotiating or some sort of big time business deal, the non-white group of that so-called powerful meeting and whatnot, they're wearing the customized clothing of white people, or it would be written in the books, the Western world, with suits and ties. They're not wearing their traditional wear, which in my mind is a sign of power. When you are in a powerful meeting, making some sort of important decision, and you're wearing the outfit or the clothing of the victor. And in this case, it's the, I look at it as the understanding of racism and white supremacy.
Yep. Global system. Mr. Fuller did talk quite a bit about his, that I think that's probably how he got some of his understanding of global system of white supremacy racism is nowhere to run. When you go overseas and you see that type of thing, you're in a whole your other side of the planet and you see that sort of thing. Now you start to get a better grasp of what do we mean when we say now you start to understand the incorrectness of segregation and integration and all that. Like, this is something way beyond like the normal way that we conceptualize this problem. Global system of racism. And the COVID situation that has been global, that is one thing. Like, man, the context of white supremacy almost inadvertently has done quite a public service, I think, unless the Rona is fake, and that should be real low at this point. Like, the number of places that we have talked, or people that we have talked to in different locations around the planet. So now we have China, Austria, South Korea, London, Brazil, Canada, Norway, Japan. Nobody thinks the Rona is fake. I'll say again, for all of the folks who have some question, suspicion, yes, white people lie about all kinds of things, anything really. That is totally different from the Rona is fake and all of this is made up. For all of the people who have taken that position, that's fine. There's victims guaranteed qualified for that too. But it would be, you would have to have astronomical evidence. Like, wow. Quadruple, like, whoa checked. Like, I mean, super, super verified. And an explanation of what all of this is. Particularly when you keep hearing individuals, Ranzo, when he says, oh man, I had a friend who died in New Jersey. Like, man, or excuse me, thank goodness he did not die. He did not die, but he said he was sick. He said he thought he could have died. Take this seriously. That was what he said, his friend in New Jersey. And then retired firefighter who's had several times, unfortunately, where he's dialed in to talk about former teammates and people that he knew who have passed away. Like, man, take this seriously. I think he even said the folks in Japan were upset that they didn't take this seriously sooner, that the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, that he might be in trouble. They call it the lame duck. That's the term that they used. Shinzo Abe, because didn't take this seriously soon enough. Sitting there fumbling around trying to see if we can preserve the Olympics, and folks are mad. Let the Rona run loose. Take this seriously. He even said he was wearing his mask. Ranzo did. I don't know if they have the mandatory. I don't remember if he said it was mandatory or not, but he did say he was wearing his mask. And in fact, he said if he forgot, he would go ahead and just buy, you know, an extra one while he's out and about. That, I think, is logical, like super logical, until we have extraordinary and quadruple checked evidence to the contrary. Anywho, we will check in with our Global Sunday Talk folks this coming Sunday. Again, time earlier in the day, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. Looking forward to hearing, because this will be our first time talking to them since the protests and everything, because they've been doing all that, you know, in lots of places, Japan and London and all over. So it'll be good to check in with them to kind of see what's transpired with that, especially because in a lot of these other places, it's going to be more of what you heard from Ranzo. They're protesting, but it's not black people out protesting. Just like in the States, here in Seattle, it's not mostly black people out in the streets. That has not been the case at any time. They were protesting right down the road in Bellevue here too. That was not mostly black people. That was a lot of white people, or non-black people. Looked like a lot of white people to me. So it'll probably be more of that as, you know, we hear from people who are in other parts of the world. I'm not sure how that will impact people's thoughts about, you know, the marches, protests, or what have you. That should be factored in. These protests is not like every time out we're talking about a whole lot of black people who look like, you know, Chris Rock and Beyonce and Lupita Nyong'o. It's not like that's what we're talking about every time it's protest. A lot of these, it's like we're talking, you know, Tom Cruise and Justin Bieber looking type folks. Like, all right, if you think that's having these folks out yelling in the street that, you know, down with the establishment, and, you know, no justice, no peace, hands up, don't shoot. They even resurrected that one. All right, VGQ. But we will check in this coming Sunday. I am excited. And to hear, you know, the evolution, what they're doing with the Rona and, you know, all that. But that'll be Sunday, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. We will have a white person, Dr. Martin Kevorkian, back with us on Monday. The list of films, The Hate U Give. Revisit, even though we read the book, but The Hate U Give film, since that has been talked about a lot this month, and folks saying you want to, you know, have a film where you can share and talk to your child about racism and with the protests that are happening, The Hate U Give, Angie Thomas. Oh, what a great book. So that's one. Two, Terminator Dark Fate, I think just came out. Dr. Kevorkian's book, Color Monitors, is all about the Terminator and that series as a representation of white supremacy racism. So I thought we should at least spend a moment on the latest installment. Number three, Breaking Two, The Electric Boogaloo. I should be a cowbell right there. I have my notes up for Black Experience Japan. Breaking Two, Electric Boogaloo, has been mentioned a lot the past month when they describe the white supremacist violence that has been taking place. They are often attributed to far-right groups and Antifa, the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo. That is what they got, the Boogaloo Boys, and then they also use it as the Boogaloo, meaning the moment when they have some sort of government failure and a clash in the street and the niggers, I guess, get out of control and they get to get their guns and go out and boom, do it to it. But that movie has been referenced a lot. And I mean, like, in a lot of different mainstream reports and what have you, NPR, Washington Post, where they'll talk about all this. It's, oh, yeah, the Boogaloo, you know, it goes back to this music form, 1960s, and then this film that came out in the 80s, blah, 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 and all that. So I said, let's watch this film. Why would they pick this term, and why would they keep associating with this movie? Should be a cowbell there as well. And then the last one, I'm disgruntled about this selection, but I'm only including it because Dr. Kevorkian and I, we had talked about Black Mirror before, and I did see this episode. I thought it would be relevant just to make sure we get a word on it. The Black Mirror Season 5 Striking Vipers episode. We're not even doing the full season, just the one episode, Striking Vipers. We'll discuss that one episode, and those will be our four, media presentations, since they're not all films, for Monday, June 22nd. Dr. Kevorkian will be with us, admitted white supremacist. This is not just time to sit and chat about movies. These films were picked specifically because of what is happening right now. The Hate U Give, Terminator Dark Fate, Black Mirror, the episode from Season 5, Striking Vipers, that episode only, and Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo. Those are the four media presentations. If you want to do some homework, check them out in advance. You could have some questions ready to roll. Dr. Kevorkian should be in the archives. He's been on the program many, many, many times over the years, all the way back to 2009 when we got back on the air. He was right there. We talked in detail about his book, Color Monitors, The Black Face of Technology in America, where he breaks down the white supremacist component to films. The Terminator, that's one of the main ones, kind of the main crux of his thesis, The Terminator, The Matrix. That was another reason that reminded me of Dr. Kevorkian. They're supposed to be making a fourth installment of The Matrix. It's supposed to be one of the big summer blockbusters for 2021, if we survive the Rona. But I saw this, like, oh, wow, Dr. Kevorkian, we talked about The Matrix, and that's a big, you know, thesis in his book and how that film represents white supremacy racism. I forgot some of those are the main two films, The Matrix series and the Terminator franchise, those two. And then he goes over some others as well. But he's been with us a number of times over the years. In fact, we did a book review of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, my favorite book all time. I've been thinking about this book, that book this week. A listener reminded me, I had forgotten, reminded me The Invisible Man does such a amazing job in terms of the scope and breadth of how it addresses white supremacy. there is a police killing of a black male in the book. That's pretty much close to the climax, or the climax of the text. And then the subsequent riot, unlike real life, they actually do steal a police horse in Invisible Man. I cracked up laughing, like being reminded of that. Like, doesn't that actually happen in Invisible Man, where he steals a horse? Didn't that actually happen? Like, yes, they stole the horse. Woo! Anywho, lots will be here, so every day from now until Monday we'll be on the air, hopefully constructive and not wasting folks' time and energy. Everybody satisfied? Anything else they need to make sure they get in before we call it a broadcast? We'll assume folks are satisfied. We'll be on every day. New book tomorrow, Einstein on Race and Racism. Hoping that that will be a constructive read, although it looks like it will be. I'm, you know, excited. Neutralizing Workplace Racism on Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Compensatory Call-In this coming Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 10 p.m. Pacific. And then, oh, the Global Sunday Talk. Yes, just made sure to mention that. That is early. Again, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. And then we'll be back to normal time for Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. So every day from now until next Monday, normal times for all the broadcasts. Just Sunday we'll be on a little bit earlier so we can make it easy for our folks on the other side of the planet to join us. But hopefully constructive. You can share the content. Let folks know we are broadcasting if you think it would benefit their understanding of white supremacy, racism. Drop an email if you have any questions, comments. We will be doing the COWS Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat, Washington, D.C. Forgot. Make sure we get that in. Or we will attempt. We'll have to see. Make sure we don't, you know, get any crazy surprises between now and August 5 through August 9th. But those are the dates. August 5th through the 9th, Washington, D.C. We'll do yoga. I have our counter-racist workshops. We'll do plant-based meals the entire time we are there. They've talked about that so much in the midst of all of this, and diet-related health issues and such. Eating healthy foods and trying to provide practical ways that people can make those changes if they so desire, so that self-care, healthy, nutritious eating is not just a fad or something cool for the year, but that is a integral, like central part of your counter-racist code, like well-being, self-care, making sure that I'm eating correctly and getting exercise, knowing racists intend for me to be in poor health, right at the center of the retreat. And like I said, having practical strategies, doing some in the kitchen workshops for meal prep and how we think about food and just what we eat, how you can, some of the easy ways that you can kind of switch up what you eat. Those are things we will be doing August 5th through August 9th, in the nation's capital. Again, hopefully the Rona and everything will cooperate, so that we can hang out for a few days, eat well, social distance, be safe, and then see if we can go back and have a safer, better 2020 as we go down the home stretch. Drop an email if you have questions, need more information, untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged for folks listening in, live archive. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. I can only emphasize, be safe. Like, that is, man, right at the forefront of counter-racism and codification right now. Be safe. Washing your, and I mean that encompasses a whole lot of things. Washing your hands, socially distancing, staying home if you don't have to be out and about. I do not think this is the time to be out in groups, large numbers of people, for lots of reasons. Just it's so unpredictable. You don't really know what's going to happen. That's, you know, you do make that choice, you know, VGQ, you make decide what's best for you. But again, that's, I'm making this choice knowing I could die in the next 5 seconds from a variety of things. Tear gas, rubber bullets, gunfire, anything, all kinds of things in that sort of environment. I know that going, and I'm all right with it. I'm ready. You know, anything happens, I'm ready for it. long as you had that mentality right on. But I do not think that that is a safe or wise decision to make. I think we have a lot of work to do with regards to countering racism that can be done quietly from a safe location. That word safety mentioned a lot today, safety, from as safe a location as you can muster from the weak and dangerous confines of white supremacy, racism. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's preserve our brain computer. We are going to need a lot of high level thinking. If you're planning on relocating and going to a different part of the world or whatever, if it's staying right here and doing the best you can to resolve this problem permanently, we're going to need our brain computer working well. Alcohol consumption is not going to help with that at all. Or any of their narcotics and poisons, really. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled every time we are in a vehicle, driver or passenger. Again, shouldn't be doing a whole lot of going out right now. Like I've been saying that for a while. I'd recommend let's try and stay in a little bit more, especially for folks in the States. I guess if you're elsewhere and you don't have gun-toting white people out on every corner, badge or no, then maybe that's a little different. But certainly in the States, I think this would be a good time to remain inside. Lot of dangers outside the residence right now. The Rona armed whites, some of them with a badge, some of them without, really have to be mindful of that. They've had so many reports this year about increased gun sales, increased sales of ammunition. You have a lot of armed race soldiers. You might not be able to see the firearm. You don't know where they have it. But, I mean, that has to be thought about. You do not want to just be... Same thing he said in Japan, you know. You don't want to be just getting into conflicts. It's not, you know, about saying you're dedicated to being nonviolent. It's just, hey, I'm in a really dangerous environment. Same thing he said in Japan. I'm in a dangerous environment, and this thing could go bad. And I'm going to be the one who gets the most damage. It's not even a question. I know that's going to be the case. And that could mean I'm the one that ends up being killed in this situation because I don't have a firearm. Even if you do, Philando Castile, Alton Sterling, a lot of those different examples. So, yeah, I would be very mindful of that as you're out and about. Or really, I would try to stay in, as I've said. If you are going to go out, I'd be strategic. Be really alert, mindful about what's happening. If anything looks peculiar, any people look a little bit suspicious, I would vacate, try it again once it's safe, but this is not really a time to take a lot of chances, unnecessary risks, lots of dangers worldwide, lots of dangers right now. Be mindful. With that, so we're sober, we're buckled. If you are driving, you're not on the cell phone. Just taking every precaution to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. I will say it again. You have a lot of armed white people. That's the theme of the year. They've bragged and boasted about being armed in public, at least in the States. If you're in Tokyo or someplace else, I guess you don't have that problem. But here in the States, lots of armed white people. Be mindful of that. Do not be reckless. Do not be careless in getting into confrontations or that sort of thing. Or if a white person is an aggressor against you, be mindful of that. You got a lot of armed white people. I know some of them are looking forward to confrontation where they can use the great equalizer, as the grandcestor would say. Sayonara. Thanks all. We're tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.